notice how some scientific controversies just refuse to stay buried? I'm Lauren, and we are kicking off a four-part series on low-energy nuclear reactions, better known as cold fusion. And I'm Hope. Over this series, we are tracing the whole story, from the basic physics through the 1989 controversy, right up to today's revival. Right. And today, in part one, we are looking at the massive physical wall that stands in the way of making this dream a reality, the Coulomb barrier, and the bombshell announcement that claimed to have cracked it. Before we get to the bombshell, though, we need to understand the ordinary physics. Right, we have to build the yardstick. We need to know why fusion is such an incredible energy payoff, and why standard physics says it is practically impossible at room temperature. Right, and the payoff is about a million-fold energy gap. Burning a hydrogen molecule in oxygen only releases a few electron volts of chemical energy. Fusing two deuterium nuclei releases millions. It's an incredible jackpot. But standard physics says there is a massive electrostatic wall in the way.
It's basically a pair of magnets pushed together, north pole to north pole. Because atomic nuclei are positively charged, they repel. To get them close enough for the short-range strong nuclear force to bind them, which only happens at a scale of a few femtometers, you have to surmount this electrostatic wall, the Coulomb barrier.
So how high is this wall, exactly? Scale it for us.
For two deuterons, it's about 360 kiloelectron volts. But room temperature thermal energy is just a fraction of an electron volt, about 0.025. That means the electrostatic barrier towers 10 million times higher than the energy inside a room temperature beaker. Classically, they never touch.
Right, which is why hot fusion projects use temperatures hotter than the sun to force them together. But what about that quantum loophole we always hear about?
That is quantum tunneling, and it's where the story gets really interesting. We'll look at that crack in the wall next and see how the math behind it sets up our 1989 bombshell.
Wait, so if standard physics says these deuterium nuclei should classically never touch, how does quantum mechanics offer a backdoor? Is that where tunneling comes in?
That's the crack in the wall.
Picture a ball trapped in a deep valley. Classically, it needs a massive kick to get over the surrounding hill. But in the quantum world, because particles act like waves, there's a tiny, tiny chance the ball just appears on the other side. That's quantum tunneling. And the math governing that probability is dominated by what's called the Gamow factor.
Okay, but at room temperature, that probability is practically zero, right? Let's talk scale. What are the actual numbers here?
Right, they are merciless. In a regular deuterium gas molecule, the fusion rate is about 3 times 10 to the minus 64 fusions per molecule per second. One fusion in a liter of gas would literally take longer than the age of the universe. But to get just 1 watt of power from a mole of deuterium pairs, you need that rate to jump to 3 times 10 to the minus 12 per pair per second.
Hold on. From 10 to the minus 64 to 10 to the minus 12? That is a 52 order of magnitude gap.
52 orders of magnitude. That is the ultimate yardstick of the cold fusion debate. To make a single watt of heat, you have to find a way to boost that tunneling rate by a factor of 100 million trillion 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 trillion. That is the miracle any room temperature theory has to explain.
Okay, here's the thing. If you actually get a watt of D plus D fusion in a test tube, physics leaves a very specific, very deadly fingerprint. In standard D plus D fusion, there are two main paths, and they happen almost equally. Half the time, you get tritium and a proton. The other half, you get helium-3 and a fast neutron. Only once in 10 million times do you get helium-4 and a gamma ray.
So it's a split ticket. But why is this called the dead graduate student problem? Picture a tiny stove burner putting out just 1 watt of heat. That sounds completely harmless, right?
Right, but at the nuclear scale,
1 watt of power requires about 1.7 trillion fusions every single second. Since half of those produce neutrons, that means your little benchtop cell is screaming out 800 billion high-energy neutrons per second. If you're standing next to that unshielded, you are receiving a lethal dose of radiation in minutes. So the fact that Fleischmann and Pons, and their graduate student Marvin Hawkins, didn't die or even get sick is actually a massive clue. Right, it's the ultimate forensic check. To explain their heat as standard fusion, you have to explain where those 800 billion neutrons went. If they aren't there, you either don't have fusion, or you've somehow bypassed the known laws of nuclear physics to suppress the neutron branch entirely. You need a second miracle. It's like claiming you've got a roaring campfire in your living room, but there's absolutely no smoke, no ash, and the temperature is barely warm to the touch. The physical evidence just doesn't match the scale of the claim. And as we'll see throughout this series, that systematic absence of neutrons and tritium is the single most stubborn fact in the entire history of cold fusion. So that is the yardstick. 52 orders of magnitude and a mountain of missing neutrons. Which brings us to the bombshell. Because against that impossible wall of standard physics, two electrochemists claimed they had actually done it. Picture March 23rd, 1989. Two elite electrochemists, Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons, bypassed the usual scientific channels and announced directly to the press that they've achieved sustained nuclear fusion on a lab bench. They claim to have bypassed the gamma factor, producing actual watts of excess heat using a simple palladium rod and heavy water electrolysis.
Which is a staggering claim because of the scale of the barrier. To get two deuterium nuclei close enough for the strong nuclear force to bind them, you have to overcome intense electrostatic repulsion. At room temperature, quantum tunneling is suppressed by over 2,700 orders of magnitude. For a watt of power, they needed a rate enhancement of 52 orders of magnitude.
Right, and the strange part is the math of the expected nuclear ash. If you actually have 1.7 trillion fusions per second, you should get nearly a trillion neutrons per second. That is a lethal radiation dose in just a few minutes. Yet Fleischmann and Pons were completely fine.
Conspicuously alive, yeah. Which means either they made a major error in their chemical accounting, like ignoring gas recombination in their open cell, or they discovered a brand new nuclear process that doesn't produce standard ash. This massive gap between the heat and the radiation is the shadow that hangs over this entire series.
Picture a classic chemical ledger.
When you run current through heavy water in an open cell, you are splitting it into deuterium and oxygen gas, which simply bubble away. This venting is where the thermodynamic accounting gets incredibly tricky.
Wait, so because those gases escape, they carry a specific amount of chemical energy out of the cell with them, right? How does that change what you expect to measure as heat?
It means a chunk of your input electricity goes into splitting the water, not heating it. We call this threshold the thermoneutral potential. For heavy water, it's exactly 1.527 volts. If you expect the gases to leave, you subtract that voltage from your heat equation. But here is the trap. If any of those gases recombine back into water inside the cell, they release that energy right back as heat.
Okay. Here's the thing. That heat is real, but your ledger doesn't expect it. So you register it as excess energy from some mystery source.
It's a phantom miracle. If you run the cell at 1 amp and just 10% of the gas recombines inside instead of escaping, it fakes about 150 milliwatts of excess power. That few percent range is the exact scale of many contested cold fusion claims. Critics like Nathan Lewis at Caltech argued that in an open, unstirred cell, you can't just assume zero recombination. You have to prove it continuously.
So without a sealed cell and a catalyst to track that recombination, a tiny, mundane chemical reaction can easily manufacture a history-making nuclear anomaly. So let's look at what actually happened to the nuclear evidence. Right out of the gate, Fleischmann and Pons had a massive math problem. They claimed watts of heat, but only reported about 10,000 neutrons per second. If that heat was real DD fusion, physics says they should have seen nearly 800 billion neutrons per second. That's a billion times too few.
Right, the dead graduate student problem. If those neutrons had actually been there, they wouldn't have survived to hold that press conference. But they tried to bridge that gap with a gamma ray signal, right? From neutrons hitting the surrounding water bath?
That's what they claimed. They pointed to a gamma ray peak at 2.224 MeV as proof of those neutron captures. But then Richard Petrasso and his team at the MIT Plasma Fusion Center took a magnifying glass to that spectrum, and it completely fell apart. First, the peak wasn't actually at 2.224 MeV. Second, the line was physically impossible. It was twice as narrow as their sodium iodide detector's actual resolution limit. It's like drawing a line with a thick marker and claiming you used a microscopic pen.
Wow, so a literal instrument limitation. Was there anything else missing from their spectrum?
Yes, a real 2.224 MeV gamma ray has to scatter. You absolutely must see a shoulder in the spectrum, called a Compton edge, at 1.99 MeV. In their data, completely missing. Plus, the overall counting rate was inconsistent with their claimed neutron flux by a factor of 40. It was just a classic instrumental artifact. Once that gamma line evaporated, their only direct nuclear evidence went with it.
So by the summer of 1989, you're left with this bizarre double miracle. To believe the claim, you have to believe they beat the gamma barrier to get heat, and that the nuclear physics somehow changed its branching ratio to hide all the expected radiation. And once the paper was out, it triggered one of the largest spontaneous replication efforts in the history of physics. Hundreds of labs rushed to test the claim. Caltech, Harwell, MIT, everyone tried. And almost immediately, the nuclear corroboration fell apart. Right, and the strange part was that dead graduate student math we talked about. If they were truly generating watts of fusion, they should have been flooded with almost a trillion neutrons per second. Yet Caltech and Harwell found absolutely nothing above background. It was a complete null result across the board.
Yes, even that famous 2.22 MeV gamma ray line turned out to be an instrumental artifact. It had the wrong width and no Compton edge. The nuclear evidence evaporated. But the intriguing part is, the heat ledger itself didn't completely resolve to zero.
But here is the wild part. Even the official audits couldn't completely kill the heat. I know the 1989 Department of Energy panel, co-chaired by John Huizinga, was deeply skeptical. But in 2004, when the DOE convened 18 reviewers to look at new data, they were split approximately evenly on whether an unexplained thermal anomaly even existed.
Yes, it's basically a locked room mystery where the weapon is missing, but the temperature of the room is still warm. While two-thirds of the reviewers rejected the nuclear explanation, half of them conceded a stubborn calorimetric residue of heat remained. It wasn't reproducible on demand, but no audit could reduce every single original run to a known chemical error. So the nuclear physics says impossible, the nuclear ash is missing, but the thermal anomaly refuses to go away. That is the exact paradox we'll be unraveling as we head into the details of the calorimetry next time.
So the nuclear claims of 89 were thoroughly dismantled. The gamma line was an artifact, and the missing neutrons made fusion seem impossible. But we are still left with those stubborn, unexplained heat readings. It is like finding a warm footprint in the snow with absolutely no tracks leading to it. That persistent thermal anomaly is the founding IOU of the whole field, and it is where our detective story really starts. In part two, we are diving straight into the messy, high-stakes world of calorimetry to see if that heat was real or just a bookkeeping error. We will see you there.